I'm currently a PM at Betterment. I used to be a PM at Amazon, and I'm happy to answer any questions about my experiences at either place. I really actually enjoyed my experience at Amazon. I think you read New York Times articles about working there, and it's like, oh boy, it sounds awful, but I actually really enjoyed it for a number of reasons. I'm happy to share that. So really two topics I'm going to touch on today. One is just measuring the business. So as a product manager, you focus a lot of your effort on the business side of the company you work at. I think of that as like sort of the macro data, and then measuring a product change. So your day to day, you're making changes to the product, you're trying to improve it, and that's more the micromanaging management of being a product manager. So yeah, data, like the way I think about data, it's just simply information used to make decisions. It's not anything more than that. I think some people try to make it out to be something extremely complicated. They're a data scientist even, and in a lot of ways, I just think about data as just the information I use to make a decision day to day. And I've got a funny example from Amazon folklore about this. So this is Amazon circa like 2012, I think. And one thing Amazon does really well is they split test everything. They call it a web lab. Other companies call it something different, but Amazon split tests everything. And back then, they were really pushing Kindle as well as like fashion. And one of the funny stories came out of the fashion team. And it may not be true, but I love the story. They were running a split test where there are two slots on Amazon's homepage, and they ran a split test with taking up both slots, basically. The bottom slot here has something, and they put something in the top slot as well. And they split tested that against what you see here. And what they observed is that if you put fashion in both of these slots, you sell a lot more clothing, but you also sell a lot more other things as well. They actually perform much better than what you see here. And because this part of the product of Amazon is so high impact, a lot of the things that you sort of have to like prove yourself out to Jeff Bezos. So the fashion team went to Jeff with this information, and Jeff was like, "Thank you so much for doing the split test. I now know how much I'm spending by putting Kindle in that slot." So a lot of misconceptions around split tests, especially, it's this is what you do. You run a split test, spits out some numbers, you do what the numbers say. That's not exactly how it's always used. I mean, for me, there are things that like that where it's just like, well, I'll just do what the numbers say. But when it comes to like strategic things, you may not necessarily just do what the split test says. So going back to data, I think about it as sort of like what should we be working on and what's going on with what we did. Just like this constant, you hear the iteration, but it really is constant iteration. You need to be always be looking at what's going on with your product. And these are the two things that I look at basically every day. There's just so much data out there. Like, no matter if you're at a small company and a big company, like Amazon, it took me 3 hours to write a SQL query. At Betterment, it takes me 4 seconds. And when people are like, "Oh, I wrote such a hard query today, it took 30 seconds to run." I'm like, we have tons of data, but like, we're tiny. Amazon has tons of data and they're huge. And no matter how small or big your company is, you've got lots of data these days. And so I think about obviously the two types of data: you get qualitative data, like customer feedback, user research, user tests, your company strategy, that's an input to how you make decisions. What your competitors are doing, that's something that coming from the Amazon School of Product, I don't think about as much, but I know it's super important in a lot of ways. Employee opinions, as a small company especially, people have strong opinions about what the product should be. Personal opinions, like this is, I love my personal opinions, so I definitely think about that when I think about what we should do from a product perspective. And of course, quantitative, this is my favorite, despite the fact that I've known that there's not a ton of numbers in this presentation. So things like traffic, feature uses, business metrics, clicks, acquisition, attrition, anything that has a number, essentially, that's the quantitative, like basic stuff. So let's switch and talk about sort of the macro side of measuring as a PM. So what I do I focus on the data that helps me best understand the inputs to the business and keep an eye on the outputs. And this notion of inputs and outputs, I find extremely valuable, but it's a little nuanced. I'm going to explain a little bit about what an input and an output is. So, inputs, like, they're the things that you can control, but they're also the things that you believe drive growth, whatever growth may be for you. It's kind of like a strategy. They're squishier. It's not quite as sort of comfortable to work with, kind of. And the outputs are sort of the opposite. So they're harder to control directly, but they're the growth indicators, things like revenue. Very easy to measure, less squishy, but and more comfortable. Like, these are the things, these are the business terms that people use to measure the performance of the company. So it, when you're talking to the management especially, they care a lot about the outputs. So just some examples of inputs and outputs. Convenience. How the heck do you measure convenience? You have to get creative about how that the data that you use to measure convenience. Traffic, that's easier to measure as an input. Usability. What is usability? How do you quantify usability? Feature adoption, again, that's another one that's reasonably easy to measure, but is an input. Customer experience, that's super important and also kind of weird and squishy to measure. Outputs, like for betterment, AUM is extremely important. That's assets under management. That's how we make money. Customer acquisition, again, that's like growth, a growth indicator. Profit, sales, revenue, just the normal things you think about in the financial statement, essentially, are types of outputs. And so when we think about inputs and outputs, how do I use it in my day to day? For example, at Betterment, this is an example. I believe that convenience, which I measure as an input, drives AUM, which is an output. So Betterment, we're a financial services company. We manage your money for you. In a lot of ways, we sort of, you trust us with your life savings. And one of the ways people invest their money is with 401ks, IRAs, and you move 401ks and IRAs between providers in a way. It's called a rollover. You've probably heard of it, but they're really a pain in the butt. But they're huge. Like I said, they're people's life savings. This is where all of their money is. So when you think about acquiring a customer at Betterment, one of the ways you think about it is, well, how do we get more rollovers? As an example of why they're not very convenient. So imagine you're rolling over an IRA from Fidelity to Betterment, as an example. Currently in the financial world, you have to print a piece of paper. You have to go to the bank. You have to get what's called a medallion signature, which is essentially the bank guaranteeing the transaction. You have to mail the piece of paper to Fidelity. Fidelity then processes it, whatever they do. They then liquidate all of your things in your Fidelity account and mail us a check to to Dallas, where we have like an electronic place that processes them, and then our ops team on 23rd Street electronically like marks the rollover as complete and deposits the check. So super, like, it's ridiculous. It's unbelievably ridiculous. So it's clearly a place where convenience is an easy, it's low hanging fruit. So I focus a lot of my effort there at Betterment. And one of the ways I think about convenience in terms of rollovers is this idea of a perfect rollover. What is a perfect rollover and the perfect rollover percentage? So, we do 100 rollovers. How many of those rollovers are perfect? And the way I measure it is, a rollover is perfect if it takes less than 14 days. So that's already a long time, but it is what it is. And the customer doesn't call us between 7 days prior and 7 days after the rollover finishes. So the idea here is we want it to complete quickly, and we don't want the customer to call us, because we believe if the customer's to call us, like, they're like scared about something. They see the typically when they call us, they see the balance in their Fidelity account go to zero. They don't see the balance in their Betterment account go to whatever balance it should be. And it's just like zero and zero, and they get really concerned. So how do we think about driving the perfect rollover percentage? Because we believe if we drive convenience as measured by the perfect rollover percentage, we'll drive AUM and growth. So that's how an input relates to the outputs. Right now, you wouldn't believe it, but the perfect rollover percentage at Betterment is between 13 and 14%. Most rollovers take between 20 and 30 days. And so this is clearly an area where we'd like to devote a lot of effort for the next year or so. Like I said, focusing on inputs is kind of uncomfortable. It's not typically the way people think about driving business, but it's super important. It's really hard to build product around increasing revenue. Like, how do you, you can't build product to increase revenue. You can build product to increase the number of things your site is selling. But you can't build products to increase revenue directly. So I think about inputs as really the things that lie between the success of your business and the products that you can build. Typically when I prioritize, for example, I prioritize around the inputs, but I also sort of estimate the outputs. So this is measuring a product change. This is related to what I talked about at the beginning with that split test. And I think split testing, if you're not familiar with it, split testing is essentially comparing two versions. So version A versus version B, and trying to answer the question, which is better? And better is one of those things like, well, what does better mean? Typically you have a hypothesis version, if we have a green button instead of a blue button, we will get more signups, for example. That's a typical basic split test. And you hear these sort of urban legends around, we change the button color and increase signups 30% or something like that. And I think those things are sort of going away. I think largely because people are getting, or customers and people are learning or building habits. So one of the fascinating things is if you go to basically every e-commerce site, the add to cart button is on the right side of the page. And it's on the right side of the page because everyone learned that the add to cart button is on the right side of the page because they shop on Amazon. And the add to cart button is the right side of Amazon. So over time, I find split tests to be harder and harder to get results from because people have developed habits. Better is a little squishy. As I said at the beginning, split tests really help you understand the business impact of a change in order to make a decision. So Jeff Bezos, when he prioritized Kindle on the slot on the Amazon homepage over fashion, was making a decision based on data, and the data was the split test results. Split tests aren't the things that tell you what to do. They're just an input to what you decide to do at the end of the day. And so when I think about running a split test, I only think about running split tests on things that are reversible. And what I mean by that is if there's no possibility that you will ever go back to the previous version, the split test isn't necessarily the right thing to do. And that really is related to large, like, architecture changes on the site. Right now, Betterment, we're doing a bunch of large changes. We're not split testing it. We're not going to go back. So the only thing split testing would tell us is what we are giving up or what we're sort of gaining from doing the change. The other thing is a few changes. So running a split test, you can't do a split test where there's like 14 things changing on a particular experience because it's not a split test. It's not AB, it's A and whatever B through Z. I don't know. It's really hard to understand like what the actual change was that influenced the change in customer behavior. So it's hard to learn from that. And the third thing is clear measurement. If you can't measure the thing, you're not gonna be able to run an effective split test. And I'll talk a little bit about that one in a second. A fourth thing that I didn't put on here that I'm thinking about as I'm talking is that I think about a lot at Betterment, for example, is we have a customer support team and they have to help our customers. So when a customer calls in and says, How do I start my rollover? The customer support person wants to do their best to help them out. So they'll say things like, well, first you go to the transfer page and you click the green start rollover button. And for all, like, if we want to split test changing where the rollover button is on the site, or changing the color of the button, or changing what the button says, it makes customer support really challenging. So one of the things that we're working on right now is better equipping our customer support team to react to what a customer may be seeing on the site. It's not a great experience if we can't help the customer in a timely fashion, or the customer support person gets flustered because they're doing this all day. They can't take a minute or 2 minutes to figure out what the customer is seeing. They really have to know. So we're adding sort of more real-time information on our customer support tool to give customer support people more information about what that particular customer is seeing at any particular time. And that enables us to do more split tests, because we've chosen to not split test things because customer support couldn't like handle the change. So I'll give you a good example, and you're not going to be able to see this, so I apologize. It's really small, but this is something that we're doing right now. When you withdraw money from Betterment, there's this confirmation screen. And one of the things that we're trying out is showing another message. And so half of our users are seeing sort of this confirmation screen. Half of our users are seeing this confirmation screen. And what we're doing is we're showing a message that's like, basically, if your satisfaction is guaranteed, if you're not satisfied, click here and you'll get 90 days free. And we want to see if that influences customer attrition or not. And so it's very clear. So it's a simple change. It's highly measurable. And it's only one thing changing. It's this box versus no box. So, and this is an example of a split test that is pretty easy to measure. It'll give us more information. What we'll do with this information isn't just simply say, well, by putting it here, it's impactful in this particular context. What we'll do is we'll learn that we can put it in other places too. So imagine if this split test turns out that most, like, fewer people withdraw money by seeing this. We'll think about putting it like in the footer of the page, on every page on the site, for example. It informs more than just this particular instance. It informs bigger, larger decisions as well.
How did you guys come up with the idea to put that, like, if someone were to find something like, oh, I don't want to get a Visa service?
Sure, that's a great question. So we changed our fee structure at the end of January this year, and as part of that decision, we did a ton of just sort of research with customers to understand like what's important to them, how they would react to certain changes, and understanding like how they think about their money, I guess. And one of the things that we learned was that by showing a satisfaction guarantee, we sort of build trust. It sort of they're more comfortable with us because it's less risky. We're a startup, obviously. We're they sort of we manage your entire life savings, and that's risky in and of itself. So this sort of helps with the risk side of the customer becoming like giving their money to us. We usually like this is the first time we're putting it actually in the experience. What we've normally done was put it in like sign up, or like on our brochure site where people are still sort of evaluating whether or not they want to use this or not. So we're seeing whether or not we believe it influences acquisition. We're seeing if it influences attrition as well. So that's sort of where the idea came from. I'm not sure if you guys have read the 4-Hour Workweek, but in there, Tim Ferriss talks about, if you say satisfaction is guaranteed, no one is going to actually take you on it. But for whatever reason, it increases, trust. And it increases trust, and trust increases the output, which is revenue, I guess.
Yeah, consumer product.
Absolutely. So this is an example of a very simple split test that like we're running it right now. honestly, we're not seeing a huge impact either way. So, we may remove this and we may not put it anywhere else, but it's something that we definitely felt we should split test, understand the impact. Yep. Yeah. So the question was, so how long do you run test? And I'll actually touch on that in a second, but it depends. It depends on how confident you want to be in the results of the test. So, and it depends on the number of people that see it, and it depends on what the expected impact of the test is. So if I've got a slide on that in a second. Yeah, so the question was, do you look at the type of people that saw which version? And the answer is yes. There's obviously an overall impact, but you want to dive in deeper to understand how certain types of folks are behaving versus other types of folks. So it may be true that a 65-year-old person, this really resonates with versus a 25-year-old it doesn't particularly resonate with. For all we know, the person actually needs their money to pay taxes or something, or to buy a house. And at the very at, on the next step, actually, we ask them like sort of why they're doing the withdrawal. So we can figure that out. I think that's super, super important because if you just take the output at face value, there's probably a lot of interesting information that gets lost that you can use in other places in your product. So I'm going to go to go ahead. Yeah. We do, but in I don't necessarily work with them, but interesting. So the question was, if sales is doing a split test and product is doing a split test, do you look at them to understand, like, do they collide, I guess? Can you give me an example of a sales split test? Honestly, I haven't worked a ton with sales teams. Yeah. Got it. Got it. So the question, like, just to repeat that is, the sales team could be running a test to reduce attrition, and you could be running a test to reduce attrition. How do you know which one is the right one? And so currently at Betterment, we don't have a good way to isolate those things. At Amazon, we just had so much traffic that an individual person would get a like. They would get a very unique experience, so you would avoid collisions. So I guess what I would say is, unless you have a super sophisticated split testing tool, don't run things at the same time. If you really want to understand the impact of both changes, which is, I mean, it's not a great answer, but I think it's the simplest solution. So this is a bad example. This is something I did while I was at Amazon. It's like simultaneously the thing I'm most proud of, but also the thing that I'm least proud of, and I'll tell you why. At Amazon, I was responsible for used stuff, like used Nintendos, for example. And one of the things that we were hearing from customers is, like, why would I buy a used thing without knowing like what condition it was in? And traditionally, Amazon was a bookstore, and used books are huge. Used books are really huge. But as Amazon sort of matured and started selling more things other than books, they didn't really change this page at all. They just sort of kept it the same. And when you're buying a used book, the condition, like used very good, is fine for you. But when you're buying a Nintendo, for example, that's 30 years old, what does used very good mean? And there are ways to put sort of descriptions here about like what it means. But ultimately, the best way to know what condition the product's in is a picture of it. So one of the things that I worked on was giving our sellers, the people that were selling these products, the ability to add a picture to describe the thing that they were selling. So you'll see here, these two listings have a picture. This is, when you click on it, you'll see this, which is great. Like, this is amazing. You can see exactly what it looks like. There's even shrink wrap on the cartridge. This is great. It would give a customer way more confidence in what they're buying. But the problem with this was, how do you do a split test? It's so hard to do a split test here for a couple of reasons. One, you can't simply say, all right, for half of customers, we're going to show the pictures, and for half of customers, we're not going to show the pictures. The reason being, sellers will get so upset. They spent all this effort to put pictures on your website. Why, like, you need to be showing it to everybody. So, A, like we could have done, we could have said, you know what, sorry, sellers, we're going to do a split test and we'll have to deal with it. But that's not a palatable solution. The other reason why a split test here is so hard is, what if this one had a picture, that one had a picture, and that one had a picture, or that one, and that one did? How do you split test? Because the customers are not seeing the same thing. If you split test it across every one of these pages, there's millions of these different pages, and they may have different like iterations or combinations of pictures or not pictures. The quality of the pictures may be different. It's just like not a good split test. It's impossible to get a great A/B. There's not a clear control. There's a clear control, but there's not a clear treatment. So I left Amazon without knowing what the impact of this was to Amazon. We tried, very challenging. But this is the thing that I'm most proud of about working at Amazon. This is, I think, really changed how people buy used and collectible things on Amazon. Not that probably no one has bought something used or collectible on Amazon, but lots and lots of people do. So really excited about that. But it was a bad split test. I'm gonna talk a little bit about how to measure split tests. So you hear a lot about this mythical p-value. If the p-value is less than 0.05, then it's significant. And that, all that says is, all the p-value says, if it's less than 0.5, is A is different than B. That's all it says. And you can configure it. Like, if you want to be 95% sure that A is different than B, you can use 0.05. If you want to be 99%, use 0.01. All it says is A is different than B. I don't really like p-values. I mean, I use them, but what I think about most are confidence intervals. So confidence intervals, they tell you where the actual number is. So where is the actual real life like impact of your change? And so here's an example of a split test. These are the only numbers you'll see in my presentation, but imagine the p-value is 0.4, version A, the mean difference was plus 0.2%. Version B, the main the mean difference was plus 3%. But from here to here, this is the 95% confidence interval, let's say, or the 95% confidence interval. And it's really hard to say, well, I mean, the confidence interval is basically the real number lies somewhere between these two, somewhere here. Like, the real number for version B is somewhere here. We don't know where. We know it's between plus 8 and minus 6. The real number for version A, it's between plus 4% and minus 3%. The mean is plus 2%, but the real value is somewhere between negative 3 and positive 4. And you'll look at this, and I think people have the tendency to say, oh, look, version B, it outperformed version A by 1%. And you can't really say that. All you can really say is version A, the change was negative 3% to positive 4%. Version B, the change was negative 6% to positive 8%. Which one do we choose? You sort of have to use your judgment. Obviously, if you run it for more time, these become much narrower. And so when you ask yourself, well, how long should I run the split test? The answer is, well, how how wide are you comfortable? How comfortable are you with this distance between the low end and the high end? So at smaller companies where you don't have a ton of data, these tend to be really wide. So you'll have things like this. So this is definitely something that you'll see at Betterment, for example. You only have hundreds, or like even if you have tens of thousands of people in treatment and control, you'll have something like this. What I like, the dream when you see this is the dream. Like, the low value of version B is greater than the highest value of version A. So you definitely know version B is better than version A. This is the dream. This is sort of the standard Amazon uses. But they can, because they have so much data. This is the dream. It never happens. It never happens outside of large, huge data sets. But like, when you think about how you talk about a split test, like I'll talk about, well, version A was -3% to +4%. Version B was -6% to +8%. I really shy away from, well, version B was 3% and version A was 2%. That's not necessarily true. We don't know what the real value is. We just know that's between those two ranges.
How do you make a business decision?
It's largely a judgment call, honestly. So, you sort of, maybe the answer is, well, let's run it for a little longer and see what happens. But ultimately, like, it's a business decision. You have to use judgment. And I think that's sort of the trap people fall into is, like, which one do you choose? Like, the data's not telling you the answer. And the answer is sort of the result of your judgment in some ways. That's a great question. So the question was, do you complement this with user interviews and other sort of qualitative data? And the answer is yes. So an example that I can think of that we've done that is, I wish I had a screenshot, but I don't. There's a button on the summary page of our product that enables you to start a rollover. And we were thinking about removing that button. And part of that choice was around, well, we did qualitative research that said, like user tests. And the user tests showed that if we ask a customer to figure out how to roll over from without showing the button, everyone figured out how to roll over. And I think that's a reasonable outcome. If you're trying to move your life savings, you'll figure out how to move your life savings. When we ran the test, what we saw was that actually less people did rollovers. So the results were something like this. Confidence intervals were all over the place. We ultimately decided against removing the button. We added it back. But that's an example of sort of putting qualitative together with quantitative data to make a decision. Because ultimately, it's a judgment call. No. And this, at the end here, I've got some hot takes, and one of my hot takes is, if a change that you make requires substantial analysis, it's probably not particularly impactful. Big changes are obvious. I think that's sort of one of my hot takes. Yeah.
What's the time frame on testing?
So the question is, what's the time frame on testing and when you make a decision? What I like to do is sort of before starting a test, I look at, well, how many people do we think are going to see it every day? And based on how many people are going to see it every day, that'll sort of tell us we should expect to see X sort of confidence by, in 20 days. So I sort of set a number of days before we even test it, because I should know reasonably well what the confidence intervals will be like in the future, just based on how much traffic we expect to see to that particular experience. So again, I think it depends, which is like the worst answer, but I think one of the points I'm trying to make here is data doesn't tell you exactly what to do. Data is just an input to your decision making. Yeah.
So if you work in a B2B company that only have like
So the question was, if you work in a, I guess the question was, if you work at a place that doesn't have a ton of customers, is split testing valuable? Yes, especially if it's low effort. If it's super low effort, it's just another input to your decision making. Obviously, you have to sort of note the caveats. But if you're comfortable with the caveats, sure, there's no downside. The only downside is, going back to my customer support example, if it causes customer confusion, then that may be a downside and you want to avoid the split test. Yeah. So the question was, what tool does Betterment use to track this stuff? We actually have our own tool. So we built our own tool internally. It's open source. It's called Test Track. It's on GitHub. So it's really early. It's not a fully functioning or like fully featured tool. Honestly, I personally run a lot of SQL myself and do a lot of the confidence interval calculations myself. At Amazon, we had an amazing tool. I wish we had it at Betterment, but we just don't. It was obviously not open source, and it's proprietary. So, yeah, completely internal. So the question was, have we used Optimizely or like Split.io or something like that? The answer is no. My experience has been at Amazon, at Betterment. And at Amazon, we had our own thing. At Betterment, and we've always had our own thing as well. We haven't really, we're starting to explore third-party tools to help us, but we haven't gotten there yet. Yeah. The question was, why do we build our own tools? I think that's a good question. I think it was largely due to the just what our needs were, and there weren't really a good, like we looked at other third-party tools, but there wasn't really something that really fit our specific needs. The second reason was our engineers are really interested in doing it themselves, and when you have a group of excited engineers, you don't want to tell them no, especially when when you think they can do a great job. So that was sort of the second reason why they wanted to open source something. They wanted to pick the problem that we had and sort of went at it. Yeah. So the question is, do we have an analytics team? Yes, we have 5 or 6 people on the analytics team. They spend a lot of their day not necessarily analyzing split tests, but really helping us understand, how sort of the outputs of the business and why the outputs are what they are. So when you think about a company like Betterment, we rely on investor money. That is, people are fickle. They react to things. The market is a huge influencer of whether or not people give us money or not. So they work on the really hard problems that I can't. I mean, I can run SQL and like calculate confidence intervals, but like Monte Carlo simulations, that's what they do. That's not something that's sort of within my jurisdiction or my ability. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 So the question was, specifically about rollovers. I love rollovers. So I love getting rollover questions. And the question was, have you tried to show customers where they are in the process? And the answer is yes. So we're doing things to help us there. Unfortunately, a lot of the process is in their own hands. So they have to print a document. And once they have to print the document, they have to go to the post office, they get a stamp, go to the bank. Like we don't have any visibility into what they're doing. So we don't know where they are in that process. And then once they sort of mail the letter or the letter to Fidelity or whoever, we don't have any visibility into what Fidelity is doing either. So unfortunately, we can't give a ton of sort of status updates in the current world. we're working on ways to do it. There are solutions that we're really excited about. Yeah, that was PDF files. So like here's. Yeah. And so, like rollovers, there's two types. Not to go in down the rollover rabbit hole, but there are rollovers from like an employer sponsored plan, which is like a 401k, and there's a rollover from another IRA. So imagine you have an IRA at Fidelity or whatever. The IRA to IRA rollovers, there's ways to automate it. The 401k to IRA rollover can't be automated. So we essentially we're doing things where we give customers the option to schedule a call with us, and we'll call your provider with you, so that and the provider, when we're on the phone with them, we'll ask them, hey, can you give us a sort of a confirmation date on when we'll receive the check, and they'll tell us that. But that's not something that a customer will know to ask. So unfortunately, there's not a good way to automate half of all rollovers. Sorry. Any other sort of questions? I got one slide left and just my hot takes. So feel free to, yeah.
So in terms of analyzing the onboarding process, is that something that the product team does, or is that also within a different function?
Yeah, good question. So the question was, like abstractly, does the product team do the analysis on the split tests? The answer is yes, but if we need help, we definitely call in the experts on doing data analysis. So it's a combination of both, I guess.
You had mentioned at the beginning that there's a macro view.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I'm sure if that's the thing done by the product team or
the macro stuff. So our data team does a lot of the macro stuff. They support our finance and strategy teams. I also do it on the side. I find it super interesting. I think there's lots of valuable insights you can find in the macro side that if you don't have any curiosity about, you're never going to discover them. Plus, as a product person, as sort of a business person, you can understand, you know where you should see some interesting things in the data. So I really, really enjoy that side, actually. I spend a lot of time on the macro, sort of what happened. That was actually something that I picked up with Amazon. You're sort of expect do it yourself at Amazon in partnership with the finance team, but it's essentially what you're expected to do there. Yeah. Good question. So the question was, what kind of data do you use to figure out what new features to build? And I use a number of different sources. So I work very closely with our customer support team. They know what customers are having problems with. They know exactly what customers are having problems with. So I look to them. They're more than willing to come to me with problems. So that's one input. I think a lot about sort of. Personally, I think about like what problems are customers having that they're sort of not talking about. And you can do that in one of two ways. One way is sort of just thinking about the problems you're having with the product and dog fooding and things like that. But the other way is through data analysis. So an example of something that customers weren't really telling us, but I could see was a problem is around sort of manually giving us money. So when you're a customer, you give us money, and you can give us money automatically by setting up an auto deposit of a certain amount, or you can give us money manually by just giving us money. And what we were seeing was on the 1st and the 15th of every month, we would get just a ton of manual deposits. We would also get a ton of auto deposits too, but a ton of manual deposits. And we were even seeing people that had auto deposits were giving us manual deposits on top of that. So the question is, well, they're clearly sort of they have to do some effort on the 1st and 15th of the month. How do we like remove that effort from them and automate and make their lives more convenient? So that is an example of how this product called Smart Deposit came about, where essentially we check your bank balance every day, and you can tell us, like, I only want $5,000 in my bank account at all times. And if we see that your bank balance is over $5,000, we will initiate a deposit for the rest. Sort of automating that extra thing that customers are doing every 1st and 15th of the month. That's an example of looking at the data, understand what customers need. Got it. So the question was, when thinking about customer feedback, when, like, how do you sort of filter the noise from the real problems? And that's a great question. One of the fun things about the customer support feedback, especially, is they're only getting the problems. Like, they are getting, like, the edge cases, and, like, how do you deal with all the edge cases? And what's interesting, though, is as you get bigger, edge cases stop being edge cases. They become sort of like normal course of business problems. And so I don't have a good answer for that, other than you sort of get a feel for how much effort your engineering team's putting into solving the problems. You get a feel for, you know, how many customers are calling about the problem. I don't think there's a right answer. I think sometimes you can, there's tangible business benefits to solving the problem. But I wish I had a perfect answer. I just don't. It's sort of a feel. Good question. So, and the question was, for a textbook product manager role, what are the skill sets? Yeah, and what's interesting is, I don't know if there is a textbook product manager role. Every company goes about product management very differently. My role changed dramatically between Amazon and Betterment, for example. So I think maybe, like, the number one thing is flexibility. I'm able to sort of adapt. Yeah, that's one. For me personally, I think number two is empathy with the customer. Like, customer focus is so important. That could just be me. I see a lot of folks sort of, the first thing they do is say, well, what are the competitors doing? And, you know, my belief is, if everyone is just looking at what everyone else is doing, you'll just get average. Like, it'll average itself out, and no one will be better than anyone else. If you focus on what the customer problems are, no matter what the competitors are doing, if you're solving the customer problems the best way, you're going to succeed. So I think the second thing is this strong customer empathy. And then third for me would be creativity. I think that's really, really important, because in a world, like, as a product manager, you have constraints. And I think the way you get around constraints is by being extremely creative. So creativity is really important. And then I would say fourth, being super comfortable with numbers, like, or being curious. If you're not, you're not going to be able to find the nuggets in the data that'll help you decide what to do. Yeah. So the question was, how do you prioritize what to do, essentially, especially the smaller company? And you'll get, I mean, there's tons of different approaches to prioritization. I think for me, there's just still so many small, like, low hanging fruit. There's just so many things that we can do that we know will improve the customer experience. The reason why I focus on rollovers is, That's where most of our customers' money is. And there's, you know, we know that for every, you know, 100 people that tell us they want to give us their IRA, 60 people are. That's 40 people that sort of get lost in the process. If we can, there's just, like, clear money on the table. So for me, at least, that's the first thing I look at, is, like, are there clear opportunities? And then, in a lot of ways, there are so many strategic things that you need to do as well. One of the things that I sort of view like strategic as the things that we have no data to support, but this is the thing that we think we should do now. And that's essentially, that's another sort of way to prioritize. Like, this is a strategic priority. We're just going to do it. Yeah, they just didn't finish. It's not bound it, at that point. They have the paperwork. It's just up to them to do it. Yeah, exactly. So it's like clear. It's clear opportunity. Yeah. Good question. So the question was, how do you manage split tests with longer release cycles? And I don't know if I have a good answer for that. We do continuous deployment, so like every day we can do a split test. Perhaps the answer is you have to prioritize your split tests, plan them well ahead of time. It's harder to iterate quickly, but that doesn't mean you can't learn from a split test, I guess. We definitely do. The question was, do we do them through prototypes? So yeah, so we use Envision. We heavily rely on usertesting.com to help us with understanding sort of the how someone would use this if it were actually in existence. I think our challenge is with a prototype or with usertesting.com, especially in our business, context is so important. Someone that's sort of being asked to do something because we sort of asked the question, hey, how would you do a rollover? They have a different mindset than someone that's like, I want to give you my life savings. And context matters a lot, especially when you add instructions or guidance within the product. So maybe not a great answer, but I think it's still possible. One question? Oh, I know the screen. I know the screen is gone. That's there's nothing left. Good? Okay. Go ahead.
Either Amazon or Betterment, have you ever gone back and retested past
changes? Good question. So the question was, have we ever gone back and retested something? I haven't personally. That's not something that I've done. I've heard of it. There's no reason to not. One of the strategies that people sometimes use is it's not an A/B test, but like an AAB test. That way you sort of get a sense of how much variation is in, like if you just compare A versus A, how much variation do you see there? You should see none, but you end up seeing something. And that's sort of a way to sort of do it, I guess. But I haven't personally done it. There's no reason to not. Go ahead. Yeah.
Do you guys have any dominance metrics that all of us in that group pay attention to? I know Facebook has a lot of attention to MOUs. I don't know if maybe it's business. Do you guys have something like that?
Good question. The answer was, are there any like Uber metrics? Uber, not the right word. Are there any like super important metrics that we look at? And for us, the important metric is net deposits. That's sort of like the output metric that we look at. I'm trying to sort of inject some very input focused prioritization and key KRs in the OKR model that are focused on the inputs. That's what we did at Amazon. We focused exclusively on the inputs. We didn't think about the outputs. Well, we did think about the outputs, but not if we weren't hitting the inputs, it didn't matter what the outputs were. Yeah.
So you talked about how the product team interacts with the customer team.
Yeah.
Value.
Sure. So the question was, what other teams do you interact with other than the customer support team? And what other teams were you thinking about? Yeah. So as a product person at Betterment, I sit. It's super traditional in the sense that I work with a designer and our engineering team to figure out what we should do. Honestly, the engineers are amazing at picking out the things that just don't make sense, the things that are sort of out of whack from the logical perspective. And typically, my belief is that if something's really complicated to engineer, it's probably really complicated. It's a pretty complicated customer experience. So whenever they say, "Oh, this is just like this is very complicated," maybe we should think about making it less complicated. So definitely work very closely with the engineering team on opportunities. I work very closely with the design team on, they understand how people use our product more intimately than I do, and strategies you can use to sort of make it more usable. So they have a large input as well. Other teams, specifically at Betterment, for example, we have an investing team. They have beliefs on what information we should show to customers on to sort of communicate the performance of their investments. So they also are a big stakeholder. And I think the biggest stakeholder that sort of outside is sort of the executive team. And they have strong opinions, especially when your founder is still there. So I try to get input from everywhere. Definitely don't exclude anybody.
Did you feel that your transition from Amazon to Betterment created a steeper learning curve because of the difference in verticals?
So the question was, how did my transition from Amazon to Betterment impact my pace of growth? Skill set, yeah. So whenever I describe my transition from Amazon to Betterment, I talk mostly about the interpersonal aspects of it. So at Amazon, you're super focused on the customer, you're super focused on your slice of Amazon. You're given full ownership over it. You could essentially do whatever you want within the resources you were given. At Betterment, though, the interesting thing that I observed was I was the 60th or something employee at Betterment. So there were 59 people that took a bigger risk than me at joining a small company. And they're very passionate about the product. So, I think about the transition, what the things I had to focus mostly on. I had a ton of data at Amazon. I don't have as much data at Betterment. So I didn't focus as much, my learning wasn't on the data side as much as it was on sort of the interpersonal side of being a product manager. That's something I didn't have at all at Amazon, maybe very little. So I think that's my learning continued. It's just I'm learning different things.